The World is supported by Israel Story, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories about regular people living in Israel, the kind you won't see on the news or online. The show kicked off season four with a miniseries called The Wall, beginning with the gorgeous tale of a Jewish Arab baby born at the Western Wall in the middle of the Six-Day War. Hosted by Mishy Harman and brought to you by Tablet Magazine and PRX. Subscribe to Israel Story on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, israelstory.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today, we're talking protests. People taking to the streets across the globe, from Lebanon to Chile to Hong Kong, and demanding change.
What's notable is the number of significant movements taking place internationally. And this is a pattern that we have seen traditionally, that there tends to be sort of an international contagion.
A contagious air of popular protests. We have several major movements covered today, and we look at why protest movements have exploded in 2019. Plus, Elton John wants you to give his classic hits a rest.
You know, I've sung these songs nearly 5,000 times, some of them, and I want to do songs that I think are just as good as the ones that have been popular for 50 years.
Sir Elton, out with a new memoir. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Anger everywhere around the globe. Protests from Lebanon to Haiti, from Chile to Hong Kong. Each movement has its own cause, of course. In Chile, for example, a protest that started over subway fares turned violent. Soldiers and tanks patrolling the streets for the first time since the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. In Lebanon, unrest was triggered by new taxes and met with tear gas. Like protests everywhere, this Lebanese movement has grown into something much larger. Now protesters are marching on the presidential palace and demanding a new government. I also mentioned protests in Haiti and Hong Kong. Add to the list Spain, South Korea, and Turkey. We'll check in on a few of those throughout today's show. But overall, we're wondering, what is going on?
There tends to be sort of an international contagion. And this is really driven by media and communications.
I'll be speaking with a professor who studies protests and what makes them effective. But first, let's zero in on Spain, where daily demonstrations have been gripping the semi-autonomous region of Catalonia. The uprising there began last Monday when Spain's Supreme Court sentenced 9 separatist leaders to up to 13 years in prison. The leaders were found guilty of sedition for pushing a 2017 referendum on independence that the Spanish government said was illegal. Many Catalans see the prison sentences as unjust. As Lucia Benavides reports from Barcelona, the court ruling is inflaming an already tense situation.
Thousands of people have been taking to Barcelona's streets every day for the past week. Most of the protests, especially those in the daytime, have been relatively calm, with people of all ages taking part, including families with small children and dogs wearing pro-independence bandanas. But at night, as student protesters take over, the mood changes.
Ya no están dispuestos a poner la otra mejilla.
19-year-old Mayol Gudon says protesters like him aren't willing to turn the other cheek anymore, and they're ready to defend themselves against the police. Almost every night, protesters have burned trash cans and barricades in an attempt to keep police officers from breaking up the demonstrations. Police have fought back with batons, rubber bullets, and tear gas. Gudon says people his age have watched the Spanish government suppress the independence movement for years. Now, their patience has run out. We've been the most peaceful social and political movement in Spanish history, he tells me, and still they've treated us like criminals and terrorists. Polls show about half of Catalan society supports the independence movement, which has been steadily growing since 2010. It peaked in 2017 when the region held an independence vote that the Spanish government declared unconstitutional. 9 separatist leaders were ultimately arrested and held without bail. Now, many are angry about the long prison sentences handed down.
A ver, nosotros somos contrarias.
Isabel Del Tell says she doesn't support the independence movement, but thinks the prison sentences are unjust. This looks like a war, she tells me as helicopters hover over the city. We're starting something that we don't know how it will end. Like many others, Del Tell wants Spain and Catalonia to engage in dialogue. Interim Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez promised just that at a press conference following last week's Supreme Court decision.
We need to turn the page and open a new chapter based on peaceful coexistence in Catalonia through dialogue within the boundaries of the law and the Spanish Constitution.
Yet these promises of dialogue, which both sides have made at times over the years, haven't been fulfilled. This weekend, Catalan President Quim Torra called Prime Minister Sánchez to talk things over, but Sánchez refused until Torra publicly condemned the week of violence in Catalonia. Though Torra had already called for the violence to stop earlier that week.
La protesta ha de ser sempre pacífica i cívica.
Catalan independence has been a divisive issue in Spanish politics for the past few years. Political leaders in Madrid have argued about how tough of a stance Spain should take, with some right-wing parties pushing for the complete elimination of Catalonia's autonomy. Jordi Nieva Fenol, a professor of procedural law at the University of Barcelona, says Catalan independence will now be front and center in the general elections coming up on November 10th. Pushing people to vote for more hardline parties on either side. He says Spain could have dealt with the independence issue less harshly.
The fact of initiating a criminal procedure, not a political procedure, not political conversations, but a criminal procedure with such high accusations has not contributed to create a climate of peace and tranquility.
Mayol Cudón, the protester, says that Spain hasn't been listening to what the Catalan people want, and that has only fueled the independence movement.
Para estar en un estado que no quiere que estés, pues la gente se quiere ir.
If the option is being part of a country that doesn't care about you, he tells me, then people will want to leave. For the world, Lucía Benavides, Barcelona.
As we said, Barcelona is just one of many places that have erupted in protests. So let's get to one of our central questions today. What makes a protest movement effective? Orion Lewis studies this for a living. He's a professor of political science at Middlebury College. He says it's not a coincidence that all these protests are happening at the same time.
This is a pattern that we have seen traditionally, that there tends to be sort of an international contagion. And so if you think about the collapse of the Eastern Bloc during the late 80s, the series of color revolutions that happened during the early 2000s, the Arab Spring, all of those had sort of a contagion effect where they were learning from each other and copying each other. And so this, to me, when you see the number of movements taking place, I think there's certainly an element to that. I think we're also at a, you know, contentious point in world history, and there could just be some general overall unrest that's driving this as well.
Recent research suggests that nonviolent resistance is more successful than violent campaigns. Why do you think that is?
I think the effectiveness of nonviolent resistance is in its ability to mobilize significant numbers of people around a particular idea or political grievance. Generally, what they try and do is contrast the nonviolence and the legitimacy of their grievance against the corruption or injustice or violence of their opponent. It also is able to use a variety of tactics, some of them such as economic boycotts that can impose real cost on a government. So Hong Kong, in this regard, is a good example where the protesters have occupied one of the busiest airports in the world. And so the price and economic cost to one of the most globalized cities in the world is quite significant in that regard.
Are protests enough, though? I mean, we're seeing large-scale protests in a lot of places this weekend especially. Do you need to accompany them with some strategy?
The more organized you are, the better able you are to frame your movement and the grievances, the better able you are to control what is going on in the streets and how that plays out. That's what makes for a more successful movement. When you have movements that are not successful at framing their message or their grievances or engage in violence, that undermines their overall message. So in this regard, I think Chile is an example where, by my reading of it, it seems to have been more violent and more focused on kind of looting and destruction of property. And that also poses an economic cost. But from a perspective of persuading the broader population, it may not be as successful. And also in terms of justifying a more repressive government response, it's not successful in that regard. And I think it's also done that.
Orion, I'm just curious, as you cast your eyes across the world this past weekend, did you detect any clear strategies? I mean, Chile, you mentioned, not really. Who's got a strategy?
The most successful cases have been in Lebanon, where protesters seem to have gotten the government to agree to a large package of economic reforms or political compromises. And so instead of responding with repression or violence, the government responded with concessions. Beyond that, I would say the protesters in Hong Kong have been very sophisticated and resilient. The Hong Kong movement is creating what I consider to be somewhat of a new models of protest in terms of really utilizing technology to create an extremely decentralized sort of movement and has sustained itself over time. And so some of those tactics and that model have been models for other movements elsewhere, such as in Catalonia, where they're explicitly trying to learn from that sort of model. So I mentioned the airport occupation, where they first shut down the airport and then they started protesting in the airport. And that's something that the Catalonians have picked up and have explicitly replicated that tactic.
What is it like for you right now, watching really any number of movements around the globe, people pushing for social equality? Is it exciting or troubling for a political scientist like you?
Well, I think it's always the best of times and the worst of times to some extent. You know, when I look at this, I see some areas where these movements can be effective, like in Lebanon. There is always the potential for repression and backlash from these movements. And I think, you know, if you've paid attention to the carnage in Syria, I think that's really been an example of how these things can go wrong. There's always potential for positive outcomes, but, you know, I'd be foolish to say that there isn't a potential for negative outcomes, too.
Orion Lewis, a professor of political science at Middlebury College, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's go to Australia now for another kind of protest. Aussie journalists are arguing, let us do our jobs. And the canvas for their protests, page one. Newspaper readers across Australia woke up today to the same image splashed across every major publication. It looks like somebody with a black Sharpie crossed out almost all the words, you know, like a redacted document. A big red stamp in the upper corner reads, "Secret." The protest was organized by the Right to Know Coalition, which includes all of Australia's major media organizations. Michael Miller is the executive chairman of News Corp Australia, which owns over 100 newspapers across the country.
Since 2001, we've seen at least 75 pieces of legislation which have restricted journalists being able to openly communicate what is going on in government. And so increasingly we're seeing that governments are becoming more secretive, being able to stamp top secret on documents that they just don't want to have exposed to the people who vote them in.
It's been a rough year for Australian journalists. The government suspected some of them of having access to national secrets about government surveillance programs. And in June, police raided a newsroom and the home of an editor. But the Right to Know Coalition is punching back. They want protections for journalists who break important, sometimes classified news. And they also want the government to stop hiding documents and overusing the label classified. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said he supports a free press, but that no one is above the law.
Scott Morrison's argument as Prime Minister that no one's above the law is a bit of a straw man.
Greg Jennett is a correspondent with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
None of the media executives running this campaign is arguing that journalists are in fact above the law. They're just asking that police not go after them when they are merely the recipients and then publishers of sensitive, sometimes classified information that comes our way.
Journalists in Australia pushing for a freer press. Later in the show, protesters pushing for change around the globe, more from the movements in Chile, Turkey, and Lebanon. One final straw might trigger a protest, but as we'll learn, there's often a deeper story to be told. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Today on the show, we're focusing much of our coverage on the growing number of protest movements across the globe. In Chile, schools are closed and people are facing long lines at grocery stores and gas stations. It all started with a hike in subway fares. A student protest quickly grew. Things turned violent. Subway stations and markets were set on fire. Chile's President Sebastián Piñera reversed the fare hike, but also declared a state of emergency, placing the military in the streets and imposing curfews. More than 200 people have been injured in the past 3 days, and at least 11 have died.
There's a lot of uncertainty. Universities are closed. Most schools are closed. My children didn't go to school. I didn't go to work.
Claudia Heiss is head of the political science department at the University of Chile in Santiago. She says even though these protests escalated fast, they don't surprise her. The situation, she says, is rooted in a much deeper tension in Chile, an inequality that dates back to a period of political repression.
In the history of Chile, we had military coup in 1973 that started a dictatorship led by Augusto Pinochet, which lasted until 1990. Pinochet became the de facto president for 17 years and committed a lot of human rights violations, exiled people, and bombed the governmental palace. And among his plans was to change the institutions of Chile.
So you're taking us back to the 1970s up through the 1990, which was the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. I thought the root of this unrest this weekend was the rise in subway fares.
Yes, that's right. It's hard to see the connection. But in reality, what happens is that we have a political system that, although has lived through 30 years of democracy, is not completely legitimate because many of the provisions of our current democracy were designed during the dictatorship. So some of the unrest, at least I think we're seeing now, caused by the rise of the subway fare, really have to do with problems of the democratic process, of the way social demands are translated into public decisions, of how much it matters how people vote at the moment when political decisions are taken and public policies are designed.
What were the changes that Pinochet ushered in that you kind of linked to the unrest today?
He created a constitution that puts the right to property above any other right. He created many supramajoritarian laws, laws that require a very high quorum to be approved, on all the matters of social life, including the central bank, the education, health, many, many issues, the armed forces. All of that cannot be decided by simple majority. It needs a very, very high majority in Congress.
So what difference did all the economic and structural changes make that were put in after the dictatorship, after 1990? Because I thought Chile's economy did pretty well, especially compared to its Latin American neighbors.
That's right. That's true. Chile has had a very successful economic development, a very successful model of export, and has created a very solid economy. I agree with that. The problem is that internally that has not translated into the well-being of the people. The inequality has increased very sharply. The provision by the state of social needs is very low. And the problem is that Chile has, we could say, has a first world economy, but has third world salaries. So people earn very little money and the cost of living is very high. So that leads to debt. You know, the subway fare increased a little bit, but it's the most expensive subway in Latin America. And the poorer people can pay up to one third of their salary only in public transportation.
And then there are just the optics of all the military on the streets and the curfews from the protests this weekend. Have you experienced anything like this in the years since the Pinochet dictatorship?
No, never. We had not seen this kind of state of emergency, which limits the right to move of the people and the right to assemble. So many friends are telling me that they had been pointed with guns by the military. I personally have 3 students injured already from the protests. So in democracy, I had never experienced something like this.
Yeah. And are younger people who are out and protesting in Santiago, I mean, people who did not live through the dictatorship, what's their reaction been to just what they're seeing?
They're much more in power. They go to the streets anyway. They challenge the curfew. And I'm very scared for my students because they don't know what this can lead to.
Claudia Heiss directs the political science department at the University of Chile in Santiago. Thank you for speaking with us, Claudia.
Thank you very much.
Do you remember Adam Ant? Not Adam Ant, the new wave rocker. Adam Ant, the cartoon character.
Adam Ant is strength, is might, is speed, is fight.
Adam Ant was fast, but is he as fast as the silver ants of the Sahara? They can cover the distance of a meter in about 1 second. That's about 100 times the length of their body in, I repeat, 1 second. That'd be like one of us humans running 400 miles an hour. Sarah Pfeffer is a biologist at the University of Ulm in Germany. Her new study about these incredibly fast ants appears in the Journal of Experimental Biology. Sarah, how did you come across these Saharan silver ants of North Africa?
There have been a lot of research with desert ants, and of course, researchers already saw these ants, and they know they are fast.
You timed them. They clocked in at 2.8 feet per second, which is 108 times their body length in a single second. If they're moving that fast, how do you follow them? How do you monitor their speed?
So we used high-speed recording to analyze those runs. Of course, you just can't take a measuring tape or clock next to your side. So we were installing some channels on the desert floor.
And so those channels, that's like little racetracks for these ants?
Yeah, exactly. You can. It's a U-shaped aluminium channel, and we just install it in the desert. So it makes the work easy for us.
Sounds like it could be fun, too, just like watching ants race. So is the speed of the Saharan silver ant, is it about the length of their legs or the speed of their legs or how many legs they have?
So they have six legs, three legs in two groups. So it's almost like walking as we human do.
Why do these silver Saharan ants move so fast? Is it about adaptation? And if it is, what are they running from?
Good question, yeah. They are living in a very hot desert environment. So to not fall victim to the heat, they need to be very fast. This is one aspect. The second aspect is that they have to go quite long distances. They are living in the desert and there is almost no food around. What we haven't said yet is that they are leaving their nest during the midday sun, which sounds crazy to go out in this heat, but there is an advantage that there are not many predators around. So the predators don't like the midday sun. They just search for some shadow to cool down. But these desert ants, they are able to go there. And, of course, if they are going there, they really need to be fast.
Yeah, it's like watching people on the beach leaving at midday and scampering across the sand. Sarah Pfeffer, a biologist at the University of Ulm, Germany, her study about the Saharan silver ants appears in the Journal of Experimental Biology. Sarah, thank you very much.
Marco Vermon, thank you.
You're listening to The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
Since the 1990s, Kurdish women have gathered in Istanbul each Saturday to demand information about their husbands, fathers, and sons who have vanished.
Çünkü talebimiz hep aynı.
This has been my mother's struggle since we were kids.
And now that struggle is taken up by the next generation of Kurds. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. U.S. troops in their vehicles were pelted with potatoes as they evacuated Qamishla in northeast Syria today. Kurdish protesters held up signs saying, "Thank you, U.S. people, but Trump betrayed us." President Trump ordered the U.S. troops out 2 weeks ago after a phone conversation with Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Turkey then invaded the Kurdish-controlled autonomous zone of northeast Syria. Since then, hundreds of people have been killed and nearly 200,000 people have been forced to flee their homes. There's been a five-day pause in Turkey's offensive. That was brokered by the Trump administration, and 5 days are up tomorrow. Elizabeth Surkov is a fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. The Kurdish commander, Mazlum Kobani, says Turkey is set on ethnically cleansing Kurds from Syria. Do you think that kind of language is too extreme?
I think the language is not too extreme, unfortunately. This is the desire of the Turkish government. And we can see this based on their previous offensive in 2018 against a Kurdish enclave of Afrin in northern Aleppo. There, during the fighting, most of the original inhabitants of the area, the original inhabitants who are Kurdish, fled the area. And then their homes were resettled by Arabs displaced from areas elsewhere. The openly stated goal of the Turkish offensive has been to take over all Kurdish majority areas of Syria, which are inside this strip of land that they call the safe zone, that is 20 miles deep into Syria, and then to send refugees who now live in Turkey into this area. Most refugees inside Turkey are Arabs. These areas are majority Kurdish. This means that even the stated objective of the offensive is to alter the demographic makeup of this region.
So you see a precedent, but what's the evidence of ethnic cleansing right now? What are the worrying signs for you?
Well, thus far, because the offensive is focused on Arab majority areas, we're not seeing this ethnic cleansing. But if Turkey is allowed to move further east towards Kamishli, towards Derik, these areas are almost entirely Kurdish. And this means that once the population is displaced, they will not, most of them will choose not to return to live under the control of Turkish-backed factions that are known for their abusive policies towards all inhabitants under their control, but in particularly towards Kurds and towards members of religious minorities. So therefore, Kurds and Assyrians and Yazidis who flee these areas are unlikely to return. And then Turkey would like to use these territories to resettle Arab refugees in them. So then we will see this process of demographic reengineering.
Many experts say Turkey has a legitimate security concern in seeking to dismantle a Kurdish-run zone that could support a Kurdish insurgency inside Turkey. You don't agree with that?
Well, I think that the links between the YPG, which is the leading constituent part of the Syrian Democratic Forces,
right, the YPG.
Is indeed, yes, the YPG, is linked to the PKK, which is an insurgent Kurdish group that has been operating in Turkey since the 1980s. Definitely, Turkey has perceives the PKK as a threat. However, the YPG has not launched any cross-border attacks against Turkey. And the PKK overall, its strength has been significantly eroded in recent years. So therefore, the operation right now seems a lot more about using Turkish military superiority and international impunity, ability basically to get away with what it is doing, to deal a crushing blow to the PKK.
So ethnic cleansing becomes an issue for you if Turkey's offensive expands?
Yes, I think thus far there's been, you know, an invasion, and the area would likely remain under Turkish control. Annexation, of course, is illegal under international law. We've seen, you know, attacks on civilians. We've seen attacks on hospitals, a host of human rights abuses. But thus far, I don't think that the ethnic cleansing has occurred on the ground. But if the operation is allowed to continue, we are straight away heading into ethnic cleansing territory.
Elizabeth Surkov is a fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
As we heard, the Turkish government has long viewed Kurdish rebels as a mortal threat. And for decades, it's tried to suppress a Kurdish separatist movement inside Turkey. Back in the 1980s and 90s, hundreds of Kurds were disappeared or murdered in extrajudicial killings. Since then, a group of Kurdish women in Istanbul have been holding weekly vigils for their missing loved ones. They're called the Saturday Mothers. Fariba Nawa tells the story of one Saturday mother and her daughter.
Hanum Tosun feels at home at the office of this human rights group in Istanbul. It was here 24 years ago that she and a group of Kurdish women launched the Saturday Mothers Vigil. On Saturdays, they would gather in Galatasaray Square to demand the whereabouts of their sons, fathers, and husbands.
When they were taking him, we didn't understand that it was undercover policemen at first.
Hanım's husband, Fahmi Tosun, was among hundreds of Kurds who disappeared in the 80s and 90s when Turkey's conflict with its minority Kurdish population was at its height. Anyone who sympathized with Kurdish separatists could be targeted. The last time Hanım saw Fahmi was October 1995. She was upstairs in their apartment when the yelling started.
He was shouting a lot. He tried not to get in the car, but they forced him. They were dragging him in. While I was trying to go downstairs, I yelled, "Get that car's license plate."
Hanım's daughter, Cihan, who was 9 years old, heard her father scream.
Yetişin, beni götürüyorlar, beni öldürecekler.
They are going to kill me. I ran downstairs with my sisters and brothers. My brother ran up to the car, but my father told him to let go because they might do the same to him.
They never heard from Fahmi again. At 53, Hanım is one of the youngest of the Saturday mothers. Many are in their 80s and 90s now, and some have died without getting answers.
Çünkü talebimiz hep aynı.
This has been my mother's struggle since we were kids.
Jian is 34 now, and when her mom can't make it to the Saturday sit-ins, she often steps in. She's studying to become a lawyer, she says, because she wants to fight in court as well as the street. On this Saturday, I meet Jian in front of the Human Rights Office. About 150 people are here for the vigil, carrying red carnations and photos. Nearby, about a dozen police officers in riot gear stand on alert.
I'm angry because the reason we're here is the government. They're just standing in front of us and actually preventing us from finding our relatives.
In the past, successive Turkish governments targeted the Saturday mothers, but the current one, led by the ruling AK Party, generally left them alone until August 2018. On the 700th vigil, police swooped in with tear gas. They arrested dozens of protesters, some of them in their 80s. Since then, the government has banned the Saturday mothers from gathering at Galatasaray. Turkish officials say they blocked the vigils because the Kurdish militia group, the PKK, was using them as propaganda on social media. The Saturday mothers say they have no connection to the PKK. For now, they've moved their sit-ins to the Human Rights Office. But Hanım says she doesn't go as often as she used to. She says it's painful to keep retelling her husband's story, and she doesn't like to discuss the details in front of her kids.
The hardest thing for me has been hiding the pain from my kids and enduring it in silence when I'm with them.
It's hard for Jian too. In fact, the mother and daughter both wait until they're alone with me to talk about what happened that night in 1995. But when they get together in the Human Rights Office, they're happy to talk about each other.
My mom is both my mother and father. She can be a very dominant force.
I ask Hanım if she's proud of her daughter, the lawyer in training. She says, yes, of course. Jian seems embarrassed, but pleased. This is something else the mother and daughter don't usually talk about. She looks at Hanım and says, thank you. For the world, Feri Banawa, Istanbul.
Just don't call it a comeback. At the age of 72, Elton John is hot. Correction, he remains hot. This year, Sir Elton has been the subject of a hit biopic, played 88 concerts, and previewed a new Broadway musical. And now he's coming out with a new memoir. It's titled Me. In it, Elton John candidly talks about his impoverished upbringing and the depths of his drug addiction in the 1980s. The BBC's Mark Savage gives us a peek into the lesser-known side of Elton John, beginning with a song he used to play before he was famous.
He may have started out recording cover versions for cheap compilation albums, but Elton John went on to become the fifth biggest selling recording artist of all time. But according to his new autobiography, Elton spent his entire career trying to impress the one person who refused to be impressed. His father.
I just wanted his approval. He's been dead for like 30 years. I'm still trying to prove things to my dad. It's crazy. But although he didn't really come to the shows or write to me a letter and say, well done, I don't think he knew how to.
Stanley Dwight was a flight lieutenant in the Royal Air Force, and Elton says he was a product of his time, uptight, emotionally stunted, and trapped in an unhappy marriage. In his memoir, the singer says he spent his childhood in a state of high alert, always on the lookout for arguments and violence. He describes himself as a shy and naive boy. So what's the connection between that child and the flamboyantly dressed extrovert we see on stage?
Well, I think I grew up in the 1950s, which was a very conservative age. I knew nothing about sex. I wasn't taught about sex. That was never mentioned to me. It was a very different place. So I grew up being very shy, not being able to wear what I wanted to do, winkle picker shoes. No, they were too disgusting. So when I became Elton John, it was like a freedom from being who I was as a kid.
You got to be a teenager in your 20s, essentially.
Exactly. That's when my teenage years happened. As you can see, I didn't waste any time. I went off like an Exocet missile, as they say.
From 1970 to 1975, Elton John was untouchable, releasing 11 albums containing timeless hits like Rocket Man, Eurosong and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. His imperial phase culminated with two sold-out shows at LA's Dodger Stadium in October 1975, at the time the largest concerts ever staged by a single artist. But Elton says he knew as he played them that he would never reach that peak again.
You have to realise you can't keep selling more records than you did before. Like Michael Jackson said, I want to sell more records than Thriller. And I thought, oh boy, you're in for a big fall because, you know, Thriller was a classic record and, you know, it sold 40 million albums at the time, which was huge. And I knew after 75 that I would find my own niche and that someone else would take over and be the next big cheese. And it doesn't matter.
Although he continued to enjoy huge success, Elton lost the rest of the 70s and 80s to drug and alcohol addiction. His autobiography paints a lurid picture of dependency, from the people he drove away to his suicide attempts and eventually the breakup letter he wrote to cocaine in rehab in 1990. He says he was inspired to be honest in the book by his two young sons.
I wanted to write a book that my boys could read when they grew up. That was the truth. And I want them to know that their dad made something of his life after a few hiccups along the way.
It's for his sons that Elton has decided to give up life on the road. He's currently 127 dates into a three-year-long farewell tour. But he hints that that won't necessarily be the end.
My dream thing, if I do perform again, I would like to do something like Kate Bush did at the Hammersmith Apollo and do a really lovely produced show. But I want to delve back into Captain Fantastic, and which is my best album. And just, you know, I've sung these songs nearly 5,000 times, some of them. And I want to do songs that I think are just as good as the ones that have been popular for 50 years. Anna Marina, Come Down in Time, Original Sin, that haven't had the chance to emerge.
Music legend Elton John speaking about his autobiography with the BBC's Mark Savage. John's memoir is titled simply, Me. It's close, only 10 days until the big Brexit deadline on October 31st. Today marked another setback for Prime Minister Boris Johnson. It came from House of Commons Speaker John Bercow. He decided not to allow a vote on the Brexit deal that Johnson reached with the European Union. Bercow said he would make no apologies for his decision.
Nothing in what I have said in any way impinges upon the opportunity for the government to secure approval of its deal and the passage of the appropriate legislation by the end of the month.
Bercow's reasoning, Parliament has already debated this issue and he was not going to agree to another vote on the same question. So now what? Johnson's government says it's going to try and pull off an extraordinary political feat, get Brexit legislation through Parliament in just 3 days' time. It's called the Withdrawal Agreement Bill. It's hundreds of pages long. Normally, this sort of bill would take weeks or even months to pass. But there's one more wrinkle about that October 31st Halloween deadline. It might be more trick than treat. The British Parliament forced Boris Johnson to formally ask the EU for yet another extension. EU officials have already granted the UK extensions twice before, though. It's not clear if they're willing to do so again. Sometimes all the back and forth just makes you want to scream.
Stop! Brexit!
That's Steve Bray. That is his real name, better known as Mr. Stop Brexit. For 2 years, Bray has been standing outside of Parliament, carrying signs, wearing trousers dotted with the stars of the EU, and a top hat with both the Union Jack and EU flag. Protesters like Bray are concerned that Brexit could cripple the UK's economy. The political paralysis has already pumped the brakes on economic growth in the UK and much of the world, and don't expect a return to normal anytime soon. Zanny Minton-Beddoes, the editor-in-chief of The Economist, says get ready for a long stretch of global economic turmoil. She says a global recession is coming and will be especially threatening to democratic institutions.
If you go into a recession with political frustration and polarization already at the levels we're seeing today, you don't have the tools that traditionally are used to combat a recession, then I fear that you could see a much bigger increase in this frustration, anger, and you could see really extreme policies. And that's the, you know, that's the sort of big worry that you've had when you've had frustration, even when actually things are going relatively well in a cyclical sense. When you get a recession and you can't fight it, then you don't have the ability to come together and combat it. And so we end up in a much worse economic place. So, yeah, the politics could get really ugly.
And when you say more extreme politics, I mean, give me an example of the kind of thing you're talking about. Connect the dots here.
Well, look, for example, at what happened in Brazil. And Brazil had had years of frustration with corruption, its deepest recession since the 1930s. And what did they do? They elected essentially a far-right leader. The idea that Jair Bolsonaro would become president of Brazil 5 years ago, I think, would have seemed completely implausible. But it was a frustration with the current establishment that led people to go for more extreme solutions.
Zanny, Boris Johnson and Donald Trump would like their constituents and the world to believe that the US and the UK can cut this big, beautiful trade deal post-Brexit. What would that look like? And are you optimistic that it would solve the problems that Brexit creates?
There's no possibility that a US-UK trade deal can make up for, in some way, for the Brits leaving the single market of 500 million consumers, which is what the European Union is. So from a British perspective, it's a second best option. Of course, you know, I'm a free trader at heart. I think a big trade deal would be a very good idea. And there are potential areas where there's enormous amount of gain to be had from barriers being cut on both sides. But I'm much more skeptical about the politics of this actually happening, for two reasons. One is that we're coming to an election year in the US. Even if you could agree on the technicalities of a trade deal pretty quickly, the idea that Congress would pass a trade deal seems to me to be pretty far-fetched right now, before the election in 2020.
A lot of other
things on
their
mind. They've got a lot of other things on their mind, and trade is not terribly popular. And the other is Boris Johnson's current Brexit deal effectively puts up a customs barrier in the Irish Sea. It treats Northern Ireland legally as part of the United Kingdom, but practically as part of the European Union in terms of trade. Now, that has driven a coach and horses through what's called the Good Friday Agreement, which is the agreement that, you know, restored peace on the island of Ireland.
Coach and horses means it's messed it all up.
Yes, that's my little Englishism. Well done for picking me up. Messed it all up. And I think for many American politicians, they will see that as a really big cost and one that they are unwilling to essentially underwrite. And a few months ago, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, came to London, and it wasn't widely picked up, but she made this point and said, don't mess with the Good Friday Agreement. And so I think that's another reason why actually there will be more resistance in the United States to a trade deal than people are expecting.
Well, Brexit, with or without a deal, is this going to mark the beginning of the end of the United Kingdom as we've known it? I mean, I know that's really hyperbolic, but I mean, do you feel Brexit is that consequential?
It seems extraordinary to say that, but it could be. And the reason it could be is twofold. Firstly, the nature of Boris Johnson's deal does essentially put a barrier in the Irish Sea. And that, to me, means that over the years, it must surely make a united Ireland more likely. And secondly, For Scotland, where many people have been agitating for independence, Scotland voted to remain in the European Union, and it is now, under this deal, being dragged into what looks like quite a distant economic relationship with the European Union, essentially against its will. I think that's going to increase the momentum for the independence movement. So, you know, yes, it does seem extraordinary, but your point is not far-fetched. It is certainly possible that 10 years down the road, the consequences of this kind of Brexit could be that the United Kingdom loses Northern Ireland and loses Scotland. And the English have their Brexit, but that they do so at the price of the Union.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes is the editor-in-chief of The Economist. Thank you very much for coming in. Great to meet you.
You're very welcome.
We've been checking in on protests around the globe today. They seem to be everywhere. In Lebanon, demonstrations have been going on for 5 straight days. They began as a movement against a proposed tax on messaging services like WhatsApp. The protests have been mostly peaceful. In fact, throughout Lebanon, they look more like parties. That was in Tripoli, Lebanon, on Saturday night. In Beirut, protesters blocked a street from a mom and young child trying to get through in their car. Instead of freaking out the kid, the protesters sang a favorite earworm for children, Baby Shark. The whole mood, the singing, partying, and protesting continued into this evening. DJ Madi K got the crowd going in Tripoli on Saturday, and we hear he's back at it tonight. From the balcony of a residential building facing a plaza packed with demonstrators, DJ Madi K set up his turntable and pumped up the crowd. He's promised to play the best mix-up revolutionary set. Turn down for what? The protesters responded to the beat with flag waving and singing Lebanon's national anthem. That's one soundtrack to anger in Lebanon. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Turn down for what?
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.